Welcome into This Week in Bitcoin, episode 119. My name is Chris, chrislas.com, jupiterbroadcasting.com. It's funny. Every major macro shift, more and more people come out of the woodwork and they start sounding like Bitcoiners. And this week, we got a lot to get into, but you could sum a lot of it up with just told you so. At least Bitcoiners told you so. The recent consequences that happened in just the last 24 hours is something Bitcoiners have warned about for ages. And I woke up to quite the surprise this morning. Just so we can really appreciate what happened today, I'm going to give you a little bit of context. It starts with a clip that went viral this week for all of the wrong reasons. It's actually a clip of Vice President J.D. Vance before the election, before he was vice president. But what he says has been echoed throughout the Trump administration since they have been in office.
That's exactly right. And by the way, you know, this is like maybe super heterodox. I am not sure that I think the reserve currency is actually good for the United States of America. I think there is a good argument that reserve currency status is akin to coal in Appalachia. It's a resource curse, right? It allows your consumers to consume very cheaply, right? That's been the story of the American economy for the last 15 or so years, even before that, is we can just borrow basically in an unlimited way because we have the reserve currency.
Well, what he got a lot of heat for is actually a well-known economic theory. It's called the Triffin Dilemma. We talked about it. Economist Robert Triffin identified this problem in the 1960s. I did a little bit about this a while ago. The idea is a country issuing the global reserve currency has to run chronic trade deficits to supply the world with the liquidity that they need. If everybody has to trade in the dollar, right? So there's constant demand. It ultimately undermines and weakens the currency of the nation that is the reserve currency because it leads to things like exporting your manufacturing. And then the money that is out there in dollars often comes back into the economy through financialization, not through investment in infrastructure. So, this has just been a general way of thinking that's been echoed by the Trump administration for quite a while. In fact, here is President Trump shortly after taking office. You might remember this exact moment.
Bring our industry back. We want to bring pharmaceuticals back to the country. And the way you bring it back to the country is by putting up a wall, and the wall is a tariff wall. We were the richest country in the world. We were at our richest from 1870 to 1913. That's when we were a tariff country. And then they went to an income tax concept, and, you know, how did that work out? It's fine. I mean, it's okay, but would have been very much better. So we'll be doing pharmaceuticals, importantly, and drugs, medicines, et cetera, all forms of medicine and pharmaceuticals. And we'll be doing, very importantly, steel.
We all remember this. I don't need to play the whole thing. Tariffs were his favorite word, after love. He thought, maybe I even like tariffs more than the word love. And there were multiple references to a time when foreigners paid for America's expenses, not Americans. I think we all recall him going on about the period of 1870 to 1913 being the richest period, and it was because of tariffs. And during this, especially in the first year of the administration, you'd hear reference to Alexander Hamilton, the first U.S. Treasury Secretary. He's famous for Hamilton economics, and amongst other things like establishing the first national bank, he advocated for tariffs and subsidies to protect and grow domestic industries, to allow certain domestic industries time to flourish. And that's what he's really known for now. So when somebody says Hamilton economics, it's sort of shorthand for that. And the administration has been signaling this since they took office, but nobody took them seriously. Everybody just figured it was probably political spin for their base or something like that. So to further drive the message early in the Trump presidency, Ambassador Jameson Greer, who is the U.S. trade representative for I don't know what, spoke at the Freedom 250 event in Davos. The event was titled, get this, quote, "From Hamilton to Today, Trade and U.S. Economic Strategy." Well, that pretty much sums up what they're there to talk about, isn't it? It's kind of wild. I mean, these people, they're just saying this stuff out in the open now. This is stuff that was quiet behind closed doors. Now they're having events and they're declaring it like it's a national pride. And in this speech, Greer lays out the new economic vision from the White House.
But we should start at the beginning. On another cold day, on December 5th, 1791, America's first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, delivered something called the Report on Manufactures to Congress. In that report, Hamilton articulated a plan for the United States to shake off its economic dependency on the British Empire. In that report, Hamilton argued for...
You might read British Empire as China today, perhaps?
...dependency on the British Empire. In that report, Hamilton argued for a strong economic policy that would allow America to become an industrial power. He called for a combination of tariffs and subsidies to incentivize industrialization. Hamilton believed that such measures were necessary to promote the development of industries, like textiles at the time, that needed protection from dominant foreign producers to develop the scale that would allow them to supply U.S. needs and also be globally competitive.
So here Greer is, he's laying out sort of the vision. And around this same time, Treasury Secretary Besant was at the Economic Club of New York for an America 250 gala dinner. These are all so fancy. And the title of this one was, quote, American Economic Statecraft in the 21st Century. So to have the Treasury Secretary, the sitting Treasury Secretary of the United States, attend an event like this, that's a pretty big deal. But yet his speech, it didn't get much attention. And in the speech, Besant directly invokes Hamilton and Hamilton economics. And in case you didn't really take him seriously, he also published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal the same day.
First is that economic security begins with national capacity. We have rediscovered at great cost what Alexander Hamilton taught us around the time of our founding, that every nation ought to endeavor to possess within itself all the essentials of national supply. That our strength, in other words, is derived from what we can build, for the nation that cannot produce what it needs is not truly secure. The nation that depends on its adversaries for critical input is not truly sovereign, and the nation that reduces its economics to consumptions is not truly prosperous. Instead, as Hamilton put it, it is essential to enlarge the sphere of our domestic commerce because economic security begins at home. It begins with the capacity to build, invent, finance, and scale the industries that will define the next
century. Okay, all right, hold on, we'll get there. Because while I don't necessarily disagree with that idea, you know, you want your military to be able to produce its own weaponry and not depend on China and then end up in a conflict with China. But him saying this and the White House signaling this is like realizing that you should probably start cooking at home and that it's healthier and it's cheaper and it makes you less dependent on deliveries to your door, which cost a ton of money. But the problem is you also sold the kitchen 10 years ago to finance the DoorDash purchases. So you don't have a kitchen anymore. So you have to rebuild the entire kitchen, buy the appliances, and you need to relearn how to cook because you haven't cooked for a very long time. Oh, by the way, you still owe payments on the debt, though. So you still have to make those payments while you're building the kitchen and learning how to cook. That's the problem. I mean, sorry, you've already made your choice. You made your choice a long time ago. The other problem is, functionally, what they're talking about, when you really wrap your noodle around what they're signaling here, what they're saying is a complete 180-degree difference from how we've done things for my entire lifetime, literally my entire lifetime. Luke Grumman explains.
The United States Treasury bond can no longer be the world's reserve asset under this, right? Basically, we've been offshoring dollars, exporting dollars and financial assets and getting back stuff. And now we want to make stuff. Well, we can't do both. And so if we start making more stuff, ultimately our deficits are going to have to be resolved in something other than Treasury bonds in particular, and in financial assets more broadly. So it has massive, massive implications for global capital flows, the dollar, rates, national competitiveness, industries, et cetera. So just massive, massive shift. Arguably, if they continue down the line, it's as big or bigger than the Berlin Wall coming down in 90 and Nixon, every bit as big as Nixon closing the gold window in 71.
Wrap your noodle around that. It's a totally different way of the United States doing business. It is, well, I guess, ambitious, foolhardily. It reminds me of the Doge effort, really. And maybe it all would have just worked out. Maybe, if not for that pesky debt, that intrinsic inflation, oh, and that hot war with Iran that just won't quit. Because those macro conditions are real and seemingly not changing anytime soon, a new normal has started to settle in, and the market spent the week quietly freaking out and repricing bonds and all kinds of things as a result. And everyone started to notice that the global bond market was starting to go under a lot of pressure.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, markets have been open for 6 minutes. Let's get down to business. The yield on the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond has hit its highest level since 2007, as investors remained very worried about inflation and government borrowing. So what does it mean for the state of our economy? Joining me now to discuss this and more, Scott Lincecone, Vice President of General Economics at the Cato Institute, and Greg Ipp, The Wall Street Journal's Chief Economics Commentator and Deputy Economics Editor. Okay, Greg, why is this happening, and what does it mean for the average American who is not focused on the bond market?
Okay, there's several reasons that long-term interest rates, which is what bond yields are going up. First of all, I think there were a lot of hopes that the Fed could cut interest rates this year, but inflation has been sticky, and with the war in Iran pushing up the price of oil, nobody thinks that's going to happen. So that's one factor. Another is that we have this federal deficit, which is approaching, actually topped $2 trillion this year. The federal debt is approaching $40 trillion. All that borrowing is pushing up interest rates. And the Treasury is now competing with all the companies building AI data centers who have to borrow money for that. So that's pushing up long-term costs. And finally, it's a global phenomenon. You look at Japan. Japan is also seeing rising long-term interest rates. What does that mean for the average family? Well, things like mortgage rates and business borrowing rates, those are all essentially benchmarked to the long-term Treasury yield. So what you're seeing in the bond market is making borrowing more expensive for every business and household out there.
I got to give it to this guy. He nervously and manically ran through all of it there in about 40 seconds. Everyone notices when the bond market starts to hit historical highs. And, well, they're the foundation of the global fiat finance system. So they underpin just about everything from mortgages to government spending. Still, I got to admit, I was a bit surprised this morning when I woke up to the news that Treasury Secretary Bessent was breaking out the checkbook and buying his own supply.
The Treasury Department is doubling the size of liquidity support buyback operations that are being used for longer dated nominal coupon securities. This impacts everything from the 10-year to 20-year sector and the 20-year to 30-year sector. So anything from 10 to 30 years on this. You can see that as a result, bond prices are rallying and yields have continued to drop. The 10-year right now is sitting at 6.49%. Just to give a little additional perspective on this, this is a process that was reintroduced for the first time in 2024 after not being used for a couple of decades before that. Back in 2025, about a year ago in July, the Treasury Department actually doubled the size at that point, the frequency of liquidity and how often they'd be doing it. They said at that point a year ago that they'd be going from 2 to 4 operations a quarter. They, again, were targeting the long end from 10 years to 30-year maturities. At that point, every operation retained a $2 billion cap. This is now doubling that cap. They're now saying that they're going to be going from the current size of $2 billion per operation to $4 billion per operation. And it is having an instantaneous and pretty severe impact on some of those yields.
Here we go. So for the Bitcoiners out there, the short version is this is the signal that the bonds aren't going to eat the debt problem. The currency is. The currency is going to eat the debt problem just like we all suspected. And this is essentially yield control through the back door. And Bitcoin is surging hard on this news. And what I find notable about that is Bitcoin is surging right now for the reasons it should be, because it is a sovereign monetary asset. They're a sovereign for monetary control asset. Right. It's surging right now because it is protection from debasement. It's surging right now because it can't be issued by the U.S. government. There can't be more created. It's pumping up like almost 6%. We'll see at the end. Actually, I could tell you right now. Let's take a look right now just because it's interesting. Oh, man. Look at this. So in the last 24 hours, Bitcoin is up 5.7%. It's up 8% since the last episode. Currently sitting at 68,420, which is the most strength we have seen since really the bear market took hold. We really haven't broke above 65 very often. This is a very strong, although maybe temporary, but a very strong pump right now. We're up. That means our 30-day price is up 5%. This is a real move here. And it's a real move for the very reasons Bitcoin was designed for. That, I think, is extremely notable and something we're going to have to think more about. Ultimately, Bitcoin is surging because the path of debasement is now clear. The Fed will ultimately have to print money to cover this. And we have gone from what Doge promised us, budget cuts and all of that, to now historical spending with this administration and letting bonds get to a 19-year high before blinking and taking action. They did drop, when I checked right after the news, they dropped down to 5.189%. Here's a little wonk analysis.
As we said, Mohamed El-Erian joins us here, chief economic advisor at Allianz, has already written about this on some social platforms. Good to see you, Em.
Thanks for having me.
Are we calling this yield curve control?
We are. We're calling it, it's really Operation Twist, like the good old days. You end up buying the long end and you'll issue more at the short end. And you're just trying to influence yields in the short term.
Does it suggest to you that 5.3 was some kind of pain point of sorts?
It does. We got a small signal when we got the joint intervention with Japan because the U.S. was worried that Japan would be selling more treasuries. But this is a much bigger signal. And it's not because of the economic implication as much as it is the political implications and the social implications.
What do you mean by that?
Well, mortgage rates go up. That adds to the affordability pressures. That's a political issue, a big political issue ahead of the election. And then you have the old issue. Do we have a K or do we not have a K?
You know, a K. Do we have a K? In other words, a K-shaped economy. It's just such a casual way to describe what is a historical divide between the have and have-nots. And the people that are at the bottom of this K are really struggling, especially with inflation as it has been for the last 5-6 years. So it's just such a cold, disconnected way. You know, do we have a K? Do we not have a K? I can't believe it's even a question.
Sure, ahead of the election. And then you have the old issue. Do we have a K or do we not have a K? Now, who gets priced out of the mortgage market? Who ends up having higher interest rates on their credit cards? It's the low-income households. So look at this as trying to address this socio-political issue that is an issue for this administration.
Does it address it, though? Because, you know, we've talked about all the different culprits for why the long end yields were going up. You know, does some sort of financial engineering actually solve that? Does it keep the bond vigilantes at bay?
So look, fundamentally, we have a race going on between the promise and the earnings that comes with AI and the cost of funding all that. That's a race going on. And that race is going to determine many, many things. Now, can you in the short term influence somehow the balance? Yes. Does it come? Is it a free lunch? Absolutely not. Every form of yield curve control, and there's many more forms of yield curve control, have collateral damage and unintended consequences.
Yeah. So we'll be watching for those. Also, I think it's notable the timing of this. The Treasury announcement happened while the Fed minutes were about to reveal more support for rate hikes. You know, they released their meeting minutes. And that would have really upset the markets, yet the markets interpreted the Treasury's intervention as essentially fiscal easing. Which, do you smell that? That smells like train brakes have burned out. Yeah, it's fiscal dominance here.
Brakes is not in service. Please make a note of it.
This is Lynn's train. This is another example of we're living in a time where the market is being driven by the Treasury in reality. And they have no choice because the cost to service the debt and the bond market have forced their hand. And the situation with Iran put the fine point on all of this. Their biggest customer, Japan, started to struggle. Japan gets most of its energy through the strait. It became a building and building problem of dominoes. So I got a question for you. Trump came in promising tariffs and, you know, reshoring, lower deficits, and a new economic model. Now we've got crazy war spending. They are putting a budget proposal in for $1.5 trillion in military spending. I've done the math on that. That's horrible. We have persistently high oil prices now since the beginning of the year. There's been pressure on the global bond markets that are causing us to do crazy things like sell euros and bail out the Japan bond market. Like, it's just getting really kind of dicey out there. And now the Treasury is stepping in to support the long-term debt. So put your macro glasses on. Do you think Iran ends up as being the decision that derailed Trump's economic agenda? Or can they still turn this around? Let me know what you think. Boost.jupiterbroadcasting.com. Go over there. Let me know. Support the show and tell me what you think. And then we'll talk about it together on the next episode. Is this situation with Iran the thing that derails it all? Like, I could almost see some of it working, but the pressures that Iran put on this seems like it could end up being historically a massive blunder by the Trump administration. What do you think? You could support the show just by doing what you're going to do. If you want to stack sats on River, use my link in the show notes to get started. One of the best ways to stack sats in the U.S. If you're all about self-custody, the Bitcoin Whale doesn't even have a wallet. Great Lightning support. Links to the Bitcoin Whale in the show notes as well. If you're ready to spend some sats, you can go from Lightning to gift card in seconds using the Bitcoin Company. And you don't even have to create an account. You can log in with Lightning. It's really great. And the only thing they support is Bitcoin. I love that. Now, check out Foldcard if you want to stack sats passively while you pay your bills and go about your daily dailies. Then, if it's time to get access to your Bitcoin without selling it, I got two recommendations, Salt and Strike. Both are great. See which one works for you. Salt has lower loan limits, but Strike has a lot of fancy payment options, lines of credit, things like that. Links to all of them in the show notes. No official relationship, but they are services I use. And you can support the show just by doing what you do. All right, we do have some boosts for this episode.
And now it is time for Le Boost.
And we're going to get into our first boost by starting with our baller this week, which is Marius February, coming in with 210 Satoshis. Hey, 210,000, I should say, obviously. Obviously, 210,000 Satoshis. BIP 110. Was just one more turn in the Bitcoin labyrinth. Sadly, we can't do that on the nation state level, as this method would be much more efficient than endless political debates, elections, and votes. It is nice that eventually it just forks off and resolves itself. It's one of the things I like about economic news in general, is eventually the bill comes due. Thank you, Marius, for that baller boost. Appreciate you.
Make it so.
Ah, the podfather, Mr. Adam Curry, comes in with 88,888 Satoshis.
I hoard that which your kind covet.
Coming in hot with the boost.
Still listening, still boosting, rip JCD. Oh, indeed. Nice to hear from you, Adam. And man, I know you hear this 1,000 times already, but JCD's death was really, it impacted me more so than I would have ever thought. I can only imagine. And I've been thinking about you and your overall situation. And I really appreciate you listening and boosting, sir. Go podcasting. Adversary 17 comes in with 58,417 big old Satoshers, whatever.
Yes, hi.
It is quite a good one. Hello, adversaries.
Thank you for helping us help you help us all.
58,417. He says, all right, I'm thinking about my cold store situation. I wrote a little Rust program to roll a virtual dice using the Rand crate, then used that running on my desktop, which at that time had been online and doing a bunch of things in the background for a while to get some random dice rolls. I'm going to check out the BitKey, also maybe an ESP32-based seed signer. You know, I like the seed signer. I also like the Jade. Jade just has had a security update. We have some more wallet security updates in the updates. And I really, really like the ESP32. Something gives me a little bit of pause about using the ESP32 as a wallet base. It just seems like such a common attack vector. But then again, you could also argue it's out in the open, a lot of eyes, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know where SeedSigner gets its random from. I would not consider the ESP's source of randomness strong enough. So what, I don't know. Something I should look into. Keep me posted, actually. Would you let me know? Not to outsource that, but I would actually be like, no, I don't think I'll have a chance to check. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Alex here with 54,321 Satushers.
Boy, they are doing a lot with mayo these days.
Thank you, Alex. He says, so relieved about BIP 110. This doesn't mean I love Sailor or have forgotten about Bitcoin Core 30 shenanigans. Bitcoin has survived another attack, though. Anyway, everyone, please donate. Keep your Fisher Free Eagle Screech and keep you. What? Okay, here. I don't know what you mean, but I'm going to give that to you right there. I know. I'm so relieved about the BIP 110 stuff, too. Derivation Dingus comes in with 21,634 Satoshis.
He's a good guy.
He's a real good guy.
No, he's a great guy.
Regarding the BIP 110 thing, I did at first sympathize with the not side, but then I never actually did switch away from Core. I just monitored things and delayed installing Core 30 for a little while. I was never interested in BIP 110. I felt like a group of people trying to force a significant rush change to Bitcoin, and that convinced me Core was the right one to stick with. Yeah, I agree, actually.
Well, I'll be dipped.
The BIP 110 medicine was so much worse than the sickness, right? Like, the Core 30 change was just a change to a default config setting that you could change. And then, like, BIP 110 came along and wanted to, like, fundamentally start changing stuff, which ultimately would have led to centralization. And look where Luke has taken it now. It's just obvious it was a bad idea. Thank you, Derivation. Appreciate you. Amunde is here with 4,444 Satoshis, a McDuck boost.
Things are looking up for old McDuck.
Three Bitcoin convergence event date. Ah, the website is correct. It is September. I did a brain fart in the original boost. Well, I'm glad I checked. So Bitcoin convergence is in September. Cool. All right. I'm going to circle back on that, as they say. Thank you, Monday. Appreciate you. Satoshi-san is here with a row of ducks, 2,222 Satoshis. The Bitcoin community got tested last week. First, cold card bug, and then BIP 110 was rejected. Thanks for the signal. Thank you.
B-O-O-S-T.
Appreciate you. Lee is here with 5,000 sats. All right. Okay, you know what? I'm going to give that a sailor.
The traders love the vol.
Good music, Lee says. Thank you, Lee. Appreciate you. Gene Bean is here with 6,666 Satoshis.
Oh my God, this drawer is filled with Fruit Loops.
Sad to see Nick's Bitcoin is shutting down. I know. It is the best node implementation if you're doing it in production at any scale. I'm hopeful that somebody else will pick it up or that my clanker will. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, seriously, like maybe we should, you, me, and Wes, we should clanker it up there, Gene. Okay. He says, here's an update. I'm not sure if it's suited for the show. All right. That's a primal link. I'll look at it later. I set up a 2 or 3 multisig with Sparrow, Jade Plus, Bitbox, Nova, and Trezor. It was easy enough, but I'm also curious on your thoughts about using Blue Vault instead of Sparrow here. I really like Sparrow. My concern with Sparrow is the developer is well known, is a public figure, seems like a bad attack surface. Maybe one of the lessons to consider from Cold Card is you don't want a tiny team behind your family wealth. However, that said, Sparrow has been amazing, has been solid. It's open source. It's great. So I still trend Sparrow. Early on in Blue Wallet's history, I had a couple of problems with it. I'm sure it's much better now, though. But I still trend Sparrow. Thank you, Gene Bean. Good question. I'd like to know where you go. Derivation Dingus, 10,101 sats. I've managed to not get any fun stolen, but I regenerated a bunch of wallets, and not just the cold card, as a result of all of this. Thanks for the inspiration from LUP, I decided to build an offline NixOS ISO with Sparrow and build a script I wrote to generate the seed phrase using devurandom. It worked like a charm, and now I can be quite sure no one else creates wallets like I do. Thanks for the value. Yeah, that's the nice thing, is that Linux random number generator is one of the best in the industry now. I mean, like, in the industry. That's nice. Good job. Thanks for letting me know, Derivation. I like your solution there. Thanks for boosting in. Oppy1984 is here with a row of McDucks.
This old duck still got it.
All right. He says, I know there's better ways to cold store my stack, but paper wallets have just worked for me. Plus, I was always uneasy about hardware wallets. I've never been able to trust them. A paper wallet generated on an air-gapped machine, I understand and I trust. On Start 9 and BIP 110, I'm currently running a Start 9 and have removed Knots, but when I open Knots on the App Store, it still shows as installed. Between their support for 110 and now this, I'm giving Umbrella a look. I may end up switching over. Yeah, and I still see, I have not been impressed so far by Start 9. I like that they put out guides helping users migrate off, but whoever's doing their social media, I don't know, the CEO, whoever it is, they don't seem to have, like, learned anything here about how they kind of misled customers and sold nodes on a false premise and all of that. Like, I don't know. They were supposed to be one of the good guys. They chose the wrong side. But I still want to leave room for people to come around, right? Because it's very useful. And they didn't completely remove choice, so I have to give them credit for that. Code 27's, thank you. Code 27's here with a row of ducks. No message, just value. Atone's here, thank you. Atone's here with 5,555 Satoshis. Luke's always been nuts. I had a positive opinion about Mechanic and Kratter going into this, though. The concern that started all this seemed to be reasonable. But as things progress, they seem to completely lose the plot. It's weird to see guys who really should know better follow a literal flat earther off the proverbial cliff. One only needs to read what Luke and co. are posting on Twitter to realize how far off the rails this thing has gone. Yeah, I know. I mean, okay, so you know, Atone, since you're reading these, I could just be sitting like in the update section of the show just going through all these crazy posts that are totally disconnected from reality. And I think really underscore the point I made last week of what a bubble they're in. That's what, everything I keep reading is like, oh yeah, this is just kind of underscoring it. He goes on to say, honestly, I worry the horrible way this was handled only hurts the prospects of future protocol upgrades, including ones that could address the very things that we were concerned about. The irrational way BIP-110 was carried out of itself was an attack on Bitcoin. Yeah, although you could argue that because of how crazy and irrational it was, right, and the obvious low threshold of 55% and the hard rush deadline for signaling and all of that, those were all lessons learned of what is a bad fork. And so maybe lessons will be learned, but it'll take time. And so, as it should, things will slow down for a little bit, I would imagine. Though you are probably seeing all sorts of opportunists now try to push their pet project through. Everything from, more storage options on blockchain to tail emissions. I mean, it's just all over the place. I don't know if you're seeing any of that. But I don't think any of it has any traction. I'm watching, but I don't think it has any traction. Nice observations, and thank you for the boost. Magnolia Mayhem's back with a row of ducks. I'm a metalhead first and foremost, but something about this song gives me chills. Oh, supporting the song. Thank you. Appreciate that, Mayhem. Tekkison's here with 2,118 sats.
Boost!
No message, just value. And user 26 is here with a row of ducks. Ah, username is Axelrod. All right, you got to put that in your Fountain profile. BIP-110 is Block Wars 2.0. Love the show. I'll get my boost going again because the coin card highlights the weakness and dangers of our current advertising model. Keep up the good work. You're on the right side of history. You know what? I appreciate Axelrod, the recognition there. Thank you. Thank you for the value, too. User 809 comes in with 10,500 satoshis.
Make it so.
Just an ongoing thank you. Well, thank you.
But that's not possible. Nothing can do that.
It can, and they did. User 809, if you go into Fountain and change your profile, too, I'll get your name next time. Kiwi Bitcoin Guide came in with 6,543 satoshis.
I like you. You're a hot ticket.
Now that we're all entropy enthusiasts, can you share some tips on how to create a seed 100% offline? The best method I found was roll a dice, then create a seed phrase offline on Tails, which is then wiped after shutdown. But I still wonder how offline that could be. I saw another boost. We're talking about using NixOS offline to do it. Do you have any tips or shared experience in this area? I don't know, man. Yes. However, I'm going to couch and caveat with saying, didn't we just learn that all of this hocus pocus magic really didn't save our butt much in the end? But it is good still in the same. It's good math and all of that. You nailed it. I don't really have anything to add. I have seen people talk about a type of box you can put your dice in and all of this kind of stuff. I feel like we're losing the plot here, though. I really resist this. I don't want the message from this show to be, you got to do this to self-custody. I want the message on this show to be, you can do this, but there still needs to be safe ways where you don't have to do this. And so that's the line I'm trying to walk right now. But I do think, like I mentioned earlier, the Linux random generator using Tails or NixOS offline is pretty solid. The problem there is you may get a little less entropy. You could always generate some and then disconnect it, I suppose. But the hardcore purists are always going to say, roll your dice, right? Tell me what you think, Kiwi, and I appreciate the boost. Anon comes in with 5,100 satoshers. Thank you for the value. Just testing my self-hosted Core Lightning Node setup. This is my first boost ever. Well, it worked. Pew, pew, pew. Well done, Anon. Core Lightning's great, too. Love Down Babylon comes in with 2,722 satoshis.
The heck?
Shoot, you got 500 more sats for my misfire. Here you go. Oh, I see. It was originally a row of ducks. I can be wordy, Chris, so here's some ducks. Regarding the cold card hack, I wanted to say this. Wisdom cuts. And when it cuts Bitcoin, it reveals diamond. True. I do feel like we're starting to internalize lessons. The cost was still perhaps too high, but that's wise words. Thanks, Love Down. Appreciate you. Ace Ackerman's here with a row of ducks. Boost! Yes, thank you, Ace. Appreciate you. Nakamoto 6102 is back with 3,500 satoshis.
Linux or something.
Thank you for the value. Thank you for the boost. Appreciate you. Ah, we have a fiat boost from the Department of Lulz.
Give me a holler when this goes south.
No message, just value. Thank you very much. And that is all of the boost. Wow, that was a good round. Thank you, everyone. I really do appreciate it. We're keeping the show going strong, and there is so much to get into, and it takes a lot of effort. So I really do appreciate you recognizing that. 28 of you stream sats as you listen to the show, and you all, look at you. We'll all be dipped. You stack 73,400 sats just streaming.
Well, I'll be dipped.
How about that? That is pretty great.
Because I'm the win.
So when you combine that all together with a couple of our generous baller boosters and our sat streamers and our fiat boost taking the current fiat value to sats, that brings our total, all combined down to sats, for this episode, 688,315 sats. That is pretty great. That is pretty great. Thank you, everybody. 8 of you used the web boosts. Not too bad. 27 of you coming in with the Podcasting 2.0 app. Pretty good there, too. Boost.jupiterbroadcasting.com. That's where you go. You can also put your support on autopilot with a membership through Fountain or Jupiter.Party. That's always appreciated. And then you get a free member boost as a Jupiter.Party member at boost.jupiterbroadcasting.com. It's all based on an open standard using the Lightning Network. And it's a great implementation of Lightning, I think, too. This is a value for value podcast, no advertiser. You are my customer, and I'm trying to make you happy. Let me know how I did. Boost.jupiterbroadcasting.com. And with that, we have more to get into. Well, you heard the milestone earlier. I think you probably caught it, but it is a big one. The U.S. is looking fat and happy with a new milestone of the largest amount of debt ever.
The U.S. national debt is expected to hit a record high as soon as this week, crossing a major threshold of $40 trillion. Our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins, joins us now to explain why that milestone is a warning sign for many economists. Lisa, remind us what this whole means and why it all matters.
Now, this is one of those moments where the fiatist of the fiat analysts start saying, like Bitcoiners.
The U.S. national debt is important to us because it helps drive the engine of our government, but it is also a cornerstone of the world economy. Those sometimes can be good things, but let me explain why this level is now a new red flag. Let's take a look and define terms. We are fast approaching $40 trillion in gross or total national debt. One major problem is that interest alone now costs more than $1.2 trillion a year for U.S. taxpayers. That's according to the Federal Reserve. So we now spend more on interest on them than we do on national defense, and basically more than almost anything else the government does. Rising debt also.
Well, for now, they want a $1.5 trillion military budget just to stay ahead of it, so that way people can't say this anymore.
And basically more than almost anything else the government does. Rising debt also adds inflationary pressure to the economy. We spoke with Carolyn Bordeaux of the Concord Coalition, and she explained the concern if this red ink line keeps rising.
Eventually, we will hit some sort of very serious fiscally induced economic crisis, which means that massive debt we're carrying, we'll keep adding to it, and eventually it will cause a very serious economic crisis. And that can take many different forms. Often it takes the form of hyperinflation, high interest rates, really, really serious problems that would be very, very difficult for us to get out of.
Yeah, that's what's going to happen. That is what I like, actually. It's not it's what's been happening. It's what's been happening for a while. And it's just getting more obvious now as the numbers get more obvious. They weren't concerned about it when it was 30 trillion, apparently. But now that it's 40 trillion, they start at corners. This is why we stack. And this is why we self-custody. Because the likely scenario is just this debasement that just completely destroys purchasing power while getting even more aggressive with yield controls and obviously rates continuing to be high, mortgage rates. So we stack. We stack Bitcoin, and we're getting it at a great price right now. So this is why I think I still am a big believer in self-custody, because that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is some sort of crazy economic crash and everybody's grabbing funds. So we self-custody, which is why I want to mention a couple of important updates. Starting with Bitbox. Bitbox 08-2026 Decinix update, or whatever. I'm probably saying that wrong. But it is an important firmware update for Bitbox owners, and I know a lot of you have just gone out and purchased one. I have one myself. They write, during our internal audits, we were able to discover and fix security issues in the Bitbox firmware. This update comes with several important security improvements for the Bitbox firmware. The TLDR is the update fixes two severe vulnerabilities in the firmware, which were internally discovered by the team. We also inform about potential application of a vulnerability already fixed in the recent update, initially discovered internally and later disclosed independently by an external researcher. There are no reports of stolen user funds, and there is no reason for anyone to panic, but we do recommend all users update their Bitbox device to the latest firmware. And my understanding, roughly, is that one of the vulnerabilities would allow for you to be, misled into installing a malicious firmware, which would then steal your keys. Probably an edge case, but update when you can. Update when you can. While we're talking about wallets, we have an update on the cold card wallet stuff. Some of this we already knew, but there is a few interesting updates and kind of bringing it all together. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes if you want to read it on your own. Law enforcement may already know, this is from Bitcoin Magazine, who emptied more than 1,000 Bitcoin from cold card wallets in the first and largest wave of the July 2026 drains. Block's investigation believes they traced the attacks on-chain sweeps to a paid account at a major blockchain data provider whose internal logs match the theft pattern with a, quote, extraordinarily specificity. Okay. And then also, kind of bringing all this together, Alex Thorne at Galax Digital Research has publicly disclosed the possibility that law enforcement already holds a concrete lead on the operator behind the largest tranche, i.e. the first wave. And in a Bitcoin Policy Institute segment hosted on their YouTube channel, Thorne said, quote, Wave 1's identity, attacker identity, may be known to law enforcement. On July 31st, Garrett posted the findings from Block's investigation, saying, quote, During our investigation of the cold card drain yesterday, we identified an unusual pattern in the sweeps. That pattern led us to a hypothesis that has since then been confirmed. The operator used a paid account at a well-known blockchain services provider to query the source's address and perform other related activity during the sweeps. We contacted the provider directly, and their internal logs matched the suspected workflow with extraordinary, again, specificity, including the number, timing, and sequence of requests. The provider was supplying its standard services in response to requests and did not reveal the broader purpose. We have seen no evidence that the provider knowingly participated or facilitated the suspected theft. Thorne and others have noted that later, smaller waves show different operational patterns, some rapid opportunistic drains followed by quick laundering, suggesting additional actors may have reverse-engineered the same weak seed space after the initial public disclosure. Weak seed space? Anyways, it's suggesting that other attackers figured out how it worked, and they started sweeping to different wallets and then tried to launder those coins. The article also goes into, you know, was it an inside job and speculation around that, and dismisses that. If you're curious, I'll put a link to that in the show notes and you can read more. We knew some of that, but I think it's worth just kind of getting it on the record. And another security update for you, Electrum 4.8.1 has been released. If you have a node with Electrum, you do need to update. This is going to happen pretty frequently. I don't know if you want me covering all of these on the show or not, but what's happening here is these projects are getting red teamed. They're discovering vulnerabilities,
And then they are discreetly telling you to update quickly before this goes public. So they say security fixes and disclosures. Quote, this release contains important security fixes. Details will be disclosed later. In other words, they're going to tell you what's really bad here, but they want to give you a little bit of time to update before the entire world knows to go put their go point their clanker at this. So go get Electrum 481, released on August 10th of this week. That's an important update for you. Now, going on right now, as I am recording, the White House is holding a crypto meeting. In fact, they may actually be live streaming some of it as I speak. I think that, I don't know, sometimes, you know how they love the cameras over there. Sometimes they do, but I don't see any obvious live streams up. But they are getting together with quote-unquote crypto industry leaders right now over there at the White House. And I think this is the White House putting together a plan B, if you will, for the Clarity Act. I think this is maybe recognition that they're going to have to do it their own way through whatever agency powers they have.
The president reportedly expected to attend a meeting with several top crypto executives of the White House this week. The meeting comes as that Clarity Act does remain stuck in the Senate, with the odds of the sweeping crypto regulation passing this year beginning to dwindle. Let's bring in Matt Hogan, Chief Investment Officer at Bidwise Asset Management, talk about some of the moving pieces in crypto. Matt, good morning. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Carl. It's great to be here.
Do we know much about what they're going to talk about Wednesday?
You know, we haven't seen a formal agenda, but we can look at the attendee list and make some inferences. When I look at who's attending, it's a lot from the crypto exchange side. It's a lot from the traditional exchange side, folks like the CME, ICE, the DTCC. I think topic number one is actually going to be tokenization. As you know, there's this huge change in how we trade everything. We're going from 9:30 to 4 to 24/7. We're going from calendar futures to perpetual futures. I think we're going to talk about this mega trend of tokenization and making sure we have the rules in place for investors to do well and for America to lead on innovation.
Yeah, we had Tom Farley of Bullish on the show late last week, and that did seem to be the tone of the discussion, is that, okay, it's going to be what it's going to be, and let's move on to maybe some other practical use cases. Sure. What do you think it means for, let's just say, the raw Bitcoin price? Anything?
Look, I think broadly it's positive for Bitcoin specifically. Bitcoin is the largest asset in crypto, and it generally benefits when the administration is focused on making crypto a hospitable place. And I think having this meeting with leaders, with the president there, is an indication of a continued commitment to crypto. So that is good for Bitcoin. The bigger winners from this, sort of the key winners, I think are actually the DeFi apps, things like Uniswap, Aave, maybe Hyperliquid, even oracles like Chainlink. The reason for that is those apps are priced today like they're serving the crypto market, which is a $2 trillion market. This kind of meeting says those apps are actually going to serve the equity market. That's a $150 trillion market, or the bond market. That's a $200 trillion market. So I think investors are going to have to upsize their total addressable market for those things. In ETF land, that means things like the Bitwise Hyperliquid ETF, maybe the Bitwise Solana ETFs, and a lot of tokenized stocks trade on Solana.
Be such a mess.
I think those are the kind of winners we're going to see.
Is there a motivation?
All right. I just want to stay with this tokenization thing for one more moment, because it just feels like something's building here that ain't great. And Vlad from Robinhood, the CEO of Robinhood, he was on CNBC to give the full-throated pitch.
Very effective.
Let's talk about tokenization, because that's something I obviously just wrote about. It's a conversation I think that's top of mind for you, but also controversial to some extent. It depends how people think about tokenization. So why don't we talk about the context with which you're describing it first?
Yeah, so tokenization, we're at the beginning of a super cycle, and it's going to take over the entire financial system.
Yikes.
Now, a month ago, we launched Robinhood Chain outside the U.S., and this is our crypto blockchain. And one of the interesting things about it is it includes stock tokens as a primitive.
What does that even mean?
Which give tokenized exposure to U.S. stocks. Now, we started with 90 of them. Now we're up to 190.
Is this like an NFT for a stock?
And these trade 24/7, and you can move them around the blockchain like you can Bitcoin or any other crypto asset.
Now, stop right there. Stop right there. You can't move it around like Bitcoin. You can't. This is crap. Who else runs the Robin chain, right? Like, this is essentially a SQL database. Yeah, you can move it around the SQL database. How frickin' great is that?
You can move them around the blockchain like you can Bitcoin or any other crypto asset.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And what they really do is give exposure to U.S. stocks to people in over 120 countries.
There it is.
I think this provides a roadmap for what the financial system can look like.
So tokenization is just as much about, gambling and giving, the plebs access to buy stuff when they're early companies, blah, blah, blah. But it's also just as much about letting everyone else out in the world grab some stable coins and buy themselves a tokenized U.S. stock. Even if they're not a U.S. citizen, even if they don't live in the U.S., they can go buy themselves $5 of Apple, right? And if you think about it, what has the U.S. benefited the most from being the reserve currency is that these nations take their surplus dollars and they put it back into the stock market and bonds and things like that. And as that happens less and less, you need more customers. You need more money coming back into the financial system from outside the U.S. because, well, let's be honest, we have a K economy. Or what do you call it? We have a K. We have a K right now. So you can't get it from the people because you've crushed them. You've destroyed them. They're broke. So you can't run your casino anymore from the customers that live there. So you need to import new customers. And that's what tokenization is really, really about. One more little piece of Bitcoin news for you and some conspiracy bacon. So let's start with the conspiracy bacon. We'll wrap up with the Bitcoin core news. So my personal conspiracy bacon, and it's really just sort of speculation from the vantage point that I have, because I don't play everything on the show that I watch, obviously. There has been a narrative forming around quantum computing for a while now. They're trying to position, they being, investors, the hype people on TV, whatnot, they, quote unquote, are trying to position it as the next big thing after AI. You've probably picked up on this. And clearly the idea is that if the AI boom starts to slow and the need for an exit becomes clear, well, you need something else you can hype up that has these long-term crazy promises that take forever to actually materialize that you can just sort of talk about and build and build and build for years. And what you're going to hear more and more, and I want you to put your filters on because you're going to hear this a lot as we start to transition to this, is that quantum computing is going to move at faster paces. Development is moving faster than ever.
Quantum computing is moving at very, very fast speed. In fact, it's unprecedented right now that we have two super cycles back to back. So we're in the middle of the AI super cycle, and quantum is right behind it. So
wait, I thought we were in the middle of the tokenization super cycle. Oh, man, three super cycles. Could it be true?
We're in the middle of the AI super cycle, and quantum is right behind it. So we've had five IPOs this year for quantum companies.
Wow.
So it's been a very, very busy time.
Five.
And what's happening is with the speed of development is the security we use today, which is called RSA security, was developed in 1977. So it's quite old and it was firmly embedded in the internet by 1994. Quantum computers soon will be able to break that encryption. And that is called Q-Day. And nobody knows when Q-Day is arriving. It could be anywhere between now and probably 2029.
Oh, I'd love to put money on that. I'd love to put some sats on that. I think they should, don't got to listen to me, but here's a little free advice. I think they should take notes from the absolute lashing, the 77% disapproval rating that the AI industry has in the United States right now. And I'm sure it's even worse in Europe. Maybe the doomerism talk isn't the way to sell people on this. Going out there and saying, yeah, we're about to crack your bank accounts, military encryption, we're coming for your Bitcoin, we're going to just wreck it all. Maybe we have learned from Sam Altman and Dario that that ain't the way to actually pitch the future product. Maybe you want to say it's going to do great things for this and that. It's going to do the XYZ, which I don't know. Is it? I suspect, the conspiracy part of me almost wonders if they have to pre-FUD Bitcoin because they don't want, don't want this free liquidity going to Bitcoin. They want it going to these pet projects that make everybody rich, that pump the entire economy, that everybody gets to ride, that they get to financialize. That's what they want, and that's what quantum's going to give them. So they're really trying to get the message out there. They really want people to figure it out. get on the pump. Just get on the quantum pump. Just start talking about stuff. You know, I went to tech events the year that ChatGPT came out, and I watched the Red Hats and the Microsofts and these CEOs essentially manifest the AI pump and revolution into existence just by making all these radical claims. They just got to figure it out. They got to figure it out. And they're going to try, and you're going to hear more about it very soon. All right. Bitcoin Core version 32 is targeted for release in October. And I'm noting this one because there's something in here I like a lot. There's a couple of things. I mean, there's a lot of nice improvements and fixes, but this one's a big one. Up to 3 times faster initial sync. Block validation now fetches transaction inputs from the disk in parallel instead of one at a time. Also, something else that's going to help is max peer connections have been raised from 125 to 200, so you have more open slots for new nodes to sync from, and faster block propagation, and a harder network eclipse to partition. All right. Lots of other nice improvements in there. I really think that if you are on an older version of Core, or if you switch to Knots and you're thinking about switching back, this could be a great release to target. And remember, you can set your own operaturn limits. It's a config option. So here's the schedule. The feature freeze is set for tomorrow as I record, August 20th. That'll be RC1. September, I guess, 10 is like the final kind of, the feature freeze is October 20th, RC1 is September 10th. Here we go. I got it now. So the feature freeze is coming tomorrow. RC comes September 10th. And then they're targeting October 10th for a release around there, depending on how everything goes. So if you're planning a node transition, October, 15th, something like that, probably a pretty safe time to target because it'll have been out for a couple of days. Any major issues would likely have been found, and you'll be good to go. So there you go, Bitcoin Core version 32. And there's a lot of others. There's a new fork, actually, that was launched this week of Knots as well, that's trying to refocus on some of the core ideas of Knots from back in the day. So, you're just going to have to keep your eyes peeled because there's a lot of great options coming for the Bitcoin node space. And Core, still a very great option, still a great piece of software, and has a lot of eyes on it. Let's check in on the state of the network. I'm wrapping up at block height 963,217. Our Bitcoin price in US dollars right now, 68,410. That puts our sats per dollar at 1,462. Now, it's not all great news. Still down 45.8% from our all-time high, which was 317 days ago. Estimated difficulty change next time, at least at this point, is an upward adjustment of 0.2%. There are 27,018 reachable Bitcoin nodes on the network. We are up 5.8% in price in the last 24 hours, 8% since the last episode, and 5% in the last 30 days. There are 431 blocks until the next difficulty retarget, and it's one sat per V-byte for an immediate transaction right now. Things are looking good. The network is strong. Well, if you made it this far, I'm going to do something a little different for now, for this week, for a couple of weeks. I'm not sure. I've recently had a problem, and it's not related to just Fountain hosting or Podhome hosting, but across multiple platforms. The platforms cannot resolve the value-for-value artist that I'm featuring. I don't know why that is, because some of them I went back and they're like, from years ago. So I haven't been able to properly credit the artist, and so some of the boosts haven't gone to the artist, so I'm putting the Value for Value songs on hold for now until that gets sorted out, so that way the artists get properly credited. But, I think it's the right thing to do, but I don't know. I'd love to know if any artists are listening what they'd like to do, because it means they also don't get exposure. Sometimes it works. Most of the time it does work. It's just sometimes it doesn't. So if you're a Value for Value music artist listening to the show, I'd like to know your opinion. Links to what I talked about thisweekinbitcoin.show. That's where you go. This is episode 119, and there's a lot of links. Stuff didn't make it in the show. My goal is to try to give you something that focuses on the signal that matters to Bitcoiners and doesn't get distracted by the emotions, the politics, or whatever it might be, right? We zero in on what matters for Bitcoiners so you can plan for yourself, your friends, your family, your future, your business, whatever it might be. Let me know how I did. boost.jupiterbroadcasting.com and boost in with what you might like to see from the show as well, because I'm always open to adding more things. There always could be, maybe there's another segment that could be in here. You never know. Calls? No, probably not calls, huh? Probably not. Probably not. So anyways, thank you very much for tuning to this week's episode. Appreciate you very much. Go check out the back catalog. I recommend digging around. You can always point your clanker at my RSS feed because there's JSON files in there and transcriptions, and you can find out the other times we've talked about some of these previous topics. All right. See you next week.